Okay, so my talk is on mirror in condensed matter systems. This actually evolved a lot in the last week, where I saw a lot of people actually already know quite a bit about mirror. So rather than just going through the very simple stuff, I'm actually going to try and offer some new insights into what a mirror is and how it works. So even if you don't know about mirror, you're going to learn some. Even if you know a lot about mirror, you're going to learn something new. If you don't know about mirror, you should still be able to follow along and learn a lot more about mirror. Okay, so just very quickly, the basic stuff. So this mirror, multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz, this was introduced by Giffre Vidal, and the main purpose was to try and efficiently represent ground states of local Hamiltonians. Okay, so I could just represent this as a unitary circuit, so each of these is a unitary gate. So I'm just mapping my initial register of, say, qubits initialized in the zero state. I'm trying to do some unitary manipulation by the circuit and output the ground state of a local Hamiltonian. So that's one interpretation. Another interpretation, you can view it sort of from the bottom up as implementing a coarse grating transformation on quantum lattice systems. Okay, and we usually think about having two types of tensors. The so-called disentanglers, which mediate entanglement between different blocks, and isometries, which act to compress, in this case, a block of two sites. You truncate one and keep one. Okay, so the key features that this, the key nice features, one is that this is efficiently contractible as a circuit. So we'll talk a bit more about that later, but what that this means is I can compute a local expectation value or a correlator, and the cost is at most logarithmic in the system size. Okay, and this stems from the circuit having a bounded causal structure. So the density matrix of three sites only depends on some small number of gates in the circuit, and the number of gates doesn't grow with the number of layers. Okay, this can also reproduce, this 1D mirror can reproduce a logarithmic correction to the area law. So S of L, entanglement entropy of a block of L scales as log L. So this feature is why we would suspect this is a good ansatz for critical systems. You also get polynomial decay of correlators, and you can capture scale invariance of critical systems. So in this case, if we impose the layers are the same as we go up, we can take it infinitely up with the same identical layers. We would call this a scale invariant mirror, and it describes this quantum state that's invariant under changes of scale by construction. Okay, you can also draw this as a tiling of the hyperbolic plane, which you've seen pictures like this before. I could have, if I'm thinking about each of these as unitary, I would have an extra leg coming out of each of these blue ones that comes out into the plane. And mirror can always be thought of as a unitary mapping between sort of the edge degrees of freedom and the bulk degrees of freedom. Okay, so this is what a mirror is. We have a lot of good arguments for why it could be useful, but in practice we have very few like analytic constructions, things we can do by hand. So if you want an example of a mirror we can find mirror for the toric code, string net models, quantum double models. All of these are zero correlation length models, topological models. We don't have any mirror for critical systems that aren't the result of a numerical process. Okay, so mirror works a lot like this. We have an input Hamiltonian, we have this box, and we output a ground state. So in this box is some kind of numerical magic. Mainly, like for instance, Bella talked about these. This can be some kind of variational optimization based on energy minimization. So this sort of figures out what these coefficients that parameterize this unitary should be. So this is all very well and good. This is powerful as a numeric approach, but you don't get a lot of conceptual insight when you just get back these big matrices of numbers. And I was here a few months ago giving a talk, and I think it was Joe made a comment that it was something along the lines of, Glenn, your last paper had 18 figures but only two equations. And it was what I took to be a criticism that we have a lot of, like we explain what to do, Well, we explain how to do these manipulations, these tensor diagrams. We show it works, but we don't have anything you can do by hand to convince yourself it would work. It's all in this numeric black box that you actually compute stuff. So I thought today it would be actually very useful to, in the case of a simple CFT, to actually go through the derivation to show how we can get a ground state mirror without resorting to this numeric magic, and hopefully gain a better understanding of why mirror actually works by going through this. So what I'm going to do is, for free spinless fermions, so just the simplest model you could think of, just a Hopping term, and for the quantum critical Ising model, I'm going to construct this family of approximations to the ground state, and show that it works. Okay, so this is work with Steve White that we're currently writing up. Okay, so before I talk about the construction of the mirror, let's just go through the basics of this model. So free spinless fermions in 1D, I have a Hopping term, I have a chemical potential. I can solve this model very easily by going to momentum modes. So if I take the Fourier transform of my spatial modes, then the Hamiltonian becomes diagonal in these Fourier modes. So probably everyone knows this simple condensed matter model. So this capital lambda is the dispersion relation. It looks like this. Okay, so all this is saying is, so of course in the ground state, modes that have negative energy are filled in. This is the Fermi C. Modes that have positive energy are unoccupied. These are, So can we represent the ground state of the system as a mirror? And this looks very simple once you take it to momentum space, but the mirror is intrinsically a real space construction, so it's not going to be so easy. And this ground state doesn't look so simple when you're probing it in real space, of course. Okay, so this is what our mirror is going to look like. So we've got a bunch of gates. Each of these gates is just going to be something that acts on two fermions. So, and if I'm preserving particle number, which I'm going to be doing, I only have one free parameter in this gate. So in this two particle basis, my gates just look like this for some angle theta. Okay, so each gate has one angle. These gates also have the property that they preserve fermionic mode structure, and that a gate like this, if I use it to transform my fermionic operators, is doing, so one gate is doing some transformation that maps two fermionic operators to two new fermionic operators that are just linear combinations of the previous ones. So this is specific to certain types of gate. And what this means is my whole mirror here is just implementing a linear map between fermionic modes. So I can think about some spatial modes living here and some, I'm going to call them mirror modes, that are at the end of each of these dots in the mirror. And so this is just some n by n unitary matrix that's mapping spatial to mirror modes. Okay, so in particular, if we look at one down here, this B naught is a linear combination of these four spatial fermionic modes. Okay, so B naught is some combination of my A modes. So I have some coefficients. These coefficients just come from just simple functions of these angles in my unitaries. Okay, so my mirror mode is just some simple function of these four spatial modes, some simple linear combination. Okay, so how should we choose these angles that parameterize our mirror? Well, it depends, of course, on the problem we're dealing with. So as a warm-up, what we're going to do is look at this free fermion model, but at a very small filling. So we've chosen the chemical potential. We've shifted it right up, so only some very small number of modes right near the k equals zero point are in the Fermi C. Okay, so this is our simple warm-up. So we have our spatial modes. some linear combination of mirror modes is some linear combination of four spatial modes, we can also represent this as a combination of Fourier modes, okay, where this capital G is just the Fourier transform of this finite real space coefficients. And what we should, the criteria in which we should try and choose, decide what these angles should be, is we want the Fourier spectrum of these coefficients to not have any component near the Fermi C. So if we are able to construct some mirror modes that only have high frequency components or only composed of things well away from the Fermi surface, then we know that these are unoccupied in the ground state and we can get rid of them. So here are some criteria to do that. We should say if we expand this in terms of Fourier modes, it should have zero component at k equals zero, and the derivative of this function at k equals zero should also be zero. So in this way, we ensure, at least in the vicinity of this k equals zero point, we're leaving things alone. Our modes are orthogonal to anything that's going on there. So constructing these local functions, well, this hierarchical set of functions that have this property is a well-known, like, this is something that's been done before, and these are called wavelets. And these have a lot of applications in all kinds of things. Okay, so the one solution to the problem I had before is theta 1 equals pi over 12, theta 2 equals minus pi over 6. This gives this particular set of coefficients or amplitudes for this expansion. And these are exactly the wavelets of the so-called D4 Dobuchet wavelets. So this is what my wavelet looks like. So it's only non-zero on four. It only has non-zero amplitude for four fermions, of course, because of this causal structure. This is what the Fourier transform looks like between zero and pi. So you see this wavelet has zero component at k equals zero. The derivative is zero at k equals zero. It only has high frequency components. And if we look at the wavelets coming from higher up in the mirror, so looking at this B1, so it's more delocalized on the boundary, but by construction, by just this, it also is zero at k equals zero in the Fourier spectrum, and likewise for the higher up ones as well. So we have this family of wavelets that are coming from different levels. All of them have zero component at k equals zero, but they're getting, this peak is moving closer and closer to the zero point. Okay, so this circuit we've drawn here, where we fix each of these guys in the zero state, is doing something, is an accurate representation of the ground state, at least in the regime where this filling remains very small. Okay, so we've identified modes which only have component in this high frequency space. We can truncate them, get rid of them from our description as we go up. Okay, but of course this is not a very interesting state. Each time we coarse grain, each time we get rid of these unoccupied modes, we're sort of increasing the effective filling if we started with some finite filling factor.
This might be obvious, but why did you choose theta to be the same in each layer?
Because we don't have to, but there is a solution that has this form. So we may as well take the simplest solution, which is choosing it the same at each layer. You could have some wavelets that depended explicitly on scale, but that's not adding anything at the moment.
Mm-hmm. So can you just say a little more clearly, like, what exactly is the free fermion buying for you here, as opposed to some more general kind of critical system?
The free fermion, yeah, that's a good point. So the free fermion, so we have a free fermion model, and it allows us to restrict our gates to a certain form. Uh-huh. So we're only considering gates that implement some linear map of fermionic
models. Like linear optics or whatever.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So we're not...
I see.
If, if, if we weren't doing free fermions, we would need some more complicated gates. These transformations wouldn't be enough.
All right, I got you.
So here we're preserving fermionic mode structure. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is the state we've constructed is not very interesting because at any finite filling factor, this construction will eventually break down. And at zero filling factor, then we just have a product state of all zeros. So there's no interesting critical fixed point happening, critical scale invariant fixed point. So that was just, but it is indeed, if you think about this as coarse grading, the Hamiltonian is doing a sensible coarse grading in that you're, from the perspective of renormalization, and that you're sort of keeping the low energy subspace and just getting rid of the high energy modes. So now let's go to the more interesting problem. So let's take this model at half filling. So clearly we're going to have to do something more complicated. Now we have unoccupied modes and occupied modes. Okay. So what we want is so these zero modes, these modes that are unoccupied in the ground state should be entirely localized in the high momentum sector, so k greater than pi over 2. So here are some constraints we can write. We can say they should be zero at pi over 2 and around pi over 2. And we're going to say it's approximately zero in this whole region, less than pi over 2. And likewise, the occupied modes, you just have the opposite constraints. So in terms of making wavelets, these two are very easy to do. Making wavelets that vanish at a point in frequency space is very easy to do. Making them vanish over a whole finite range of frequency space is very hard to do. But I'll show, so we can satisfy these ones exactly, but we're only going to get approximately satisfy these ones. And the uncertainty relation means we can never fully localize our wavelets in frequency space because they have a finite support in real space. So first of all, how do we satisfy these easy constraints? So they should vanish at frequency plus or minus pi over 2. We can do this just by some simple deformation of the wavelets we already have. Okay, so what I'm going to do is my scaling, my coefficients of my wavelets, I'm just going to multiply it by a phase. So e to the I r pi, which just shifts it in frequency space. And I'm going to do some dilation, which again just doubles it in frequency space. So what does this look like? So my wavelets now, so this phase shift and dilation, so now there's zero on every second site. So I've just dilated them and added some phase. So now I've shifted the zero of the wavelet to pi over 2, and it now has a peak at zero in pi. Okay, so as a circuit, this is how I could represent this. So at the moment, I'm just leaving. So I have an AB sublattice, so I'm just leaving the B lattice trivial. I'm doing a circuit that's only non-trivial on the A lattice, and I've added some extra guys here that just implement the phase change, so only on every second site. Okay, so, and this is what these wavelets, these deformed wavelets look like from the higher layers. So they look very ugly, but again, they have the appropriate part of the frequency response we're looking for, and that they're zero at this pi over 2, and they're flat in the vicinity of pi over 2. Okay, so we're part of the way there. How do we get this more difficult constraint that the wavelets should be zero? So this is what we have. We want it now to be finite in one region and completely flat, or as flat as possible over this whole region here. This is very tough. What we're going to do is take two copies of this circuit, one on the A lattice, one on the B sublattice, and we're going to try and satisfy this constraint by taking symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations of these two guys. Okay, this is what this circuit looks like. So just taking this circuit, I've put another one facing the other way. Okay, so this is my theta 1 and theta 2. So here I have minus theta 1 and minus theta 2 because I've taken the previous circuit and then a spatial inversion, which just changes the sign of the angle. So I have these two circuits I've put together, one on the A sublattice, one on the B sublattice, and then I've just coupled them together with these pi over 4 gates, which are just creating the symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations of these wavelets. So there's a lot of fiddling with this to get it lined up, so you need some sort of extra, you need some extra layer that only happens at the bottom just to line things up correctly, and then it's scale invariant after that. But when you do this, now let's look at the wavelets that come from this circuit. What we find is by doing this correctly, we can create this. So this is the symmetric combination of two of my previous wavelets, and now it's pretty well localized in this low momentum sector. So there's some little wiggle here, which has to be there. It can't be exactly localized in one sector, but it does pretty well. Okay, and likewise, when I look at the anti-symmetric combination of two wavelets, so corresponding to this one, I get wavelets which are localized just in the high momentum part.
Glenn, I think we've maybe been talking about this, but what are those circles at the very bottom? Are those just...
This phase shift I told you about before just puts a minus sign in every second site. These just do that. So it's just something. I mean, this is just some... These are what we call the transitional layers. They just do some local manipulation before we actually do the mirror proper, in some sense.
So why are you doing that? Does that have to do with the half filling? It's every other...
It's just essentially putting the problem in appropriate form that it can be scale invariant thereafter. So I couldn't...
I mean, you're just adding pi momentum, right? To shift the left mover to the right mover?
I'm not sure. The explanation for why you couldn't just have a purely scale invariant description, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, this is just the way it seemed to work, the easiest way to do it.
It has to do with fermion doubling or something? That's when it's sounding
right. Maybe. I mean, maybe you could just have a purely scale invariant description. It's not unreasonable, but this is the way this construction works, at least. Hey. And I think this is actually a very surprising result, that this very simple looking circuit actually does a very good job of preparing the ground state of these free fermions. So this is, in real space, this is sort of a very non-trivial ground state, and now we have a relatively simple circuit that will prepare the ground state. And this will give me a pretty reasonable result in terms of ground energy and local observables. The entanglement entropy of this state I'm preparing is going to be very good. Also, the conformal data of this lattice CFT is also pretty accurately encoded in this ground state, as I'll show you later on.
Can you give an analytic error estimate?
Maybe. I mean, you can work out these guys analytically, so... this would be a good toy model if you want to try and figure out how the mirror works in accuracy scaling. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, the RG flow of the Hamiltonian by construction is working well, in the sense that this is our dispersion relation. If we think about each of these layers as implementing a coarse graining, by construction, it's not touching what happens at minus pi over 2 and pi over 2, and in the vicinity of this, so these modes we're truncating sort of only have non-zero weight away from these points. So it's really preserving the low energy subspace. It's tending to a gapless Hamiltonian that has a straighter dispersion than this one. So can we get some further insight into how this is working? So as I said before, this circuit is implementing a linear map of fermionic modes, so some B-direct B dagger up here in the bulk is mapped to some linear combination of my spatial modes on the boundary. What this linear combination is just this. So this is what the amplitudes look like on the even lattice and the odd sublattice. This is what it looks like in the limit as if I went down to the very bottom, or if I started deep in the bulk. So these are just my Dobuchet wavelets, just off-the-shelf Dobuchet wavelets that are sort of very, very familiar. Hey, but if I'm looking at in terms of what happened, if I'm looking at what happens in terms of the state, so this pi over 4 gate is creating an entangled state of a particle being in two places. These gates are just smearing out the particle on the boundary. They don't actually communicate between the two sublattices after this point. So actually, how I can interpret this is, so I'm creating a pair of entangled particles with this gate and just spreading them out. So what this is doing is, what this little circuit is doing is just creating sort of an entangled state of a quasi-particle on the boundary. So I call this a quasi-particle because it has some narrow momentum distribution. Okay, so this sort of connects with this very familiar picture of the mirror, where we think of things happening down the bottom as generating these sort of entanglement at short length scales. So here I'm just generating some entangled state of a particle in sort of finite region. As I look at the higher mirror layers, they're generating some sort of entangled state of a particle on some much larger region. Okay, and so so usually this is sort of a very hand wavy argument here, where actually we have a very concrete picture showing that this actually happens. And this is one way you can understand, for instance, why a mirror is giving you logarithmic scaling of entanglement. So this is my circuit I came up with. The question you might ask is, this doesn't actually look like a normal mirror. Is this indeed a normal mirror in disguise? And it is, if I just make some grouping of several gates into a tensor. So here, each line was carrying one fermionic mode. It was bond dimension 2. If I group two of these guys together in pairs, I just get a bond dimension 4 tensor. And under this mapping, it's just a normal mirror. So I have to, because I'm dealing in fermionic degrees of freedom, I have to treat this swap as a fermionic swap if I want to get the tensor representation, as Bella said earlier. Okay. So this was sort of the lowest order solution, and it's approximate. Can I sort of construct better approximations, more refined approximations to this ground state? Yes. So what we're going to do is essentially go to higher order wavelets. So this involves each layer of the mirror now has more unitary gates added. So we have more parameters to play with, and our wavelets are now more, have a larger support in space, so we can better localize them in momentum space. Okay, so this is the solution we had previously, and it came from these wavelets were chosen, the angles were chosen to exactly satisfy two equations. So I didn't go through the details, but this is actually just a simple calculation. They do a lot in wavelets. So now the next simplest solution I was able to construct, you have four different gates, four different angles. Okay, so we're actually just fixing one of them. It's just a pi over 2 gate. It just generates some shift we need for proper alignment. So the other three parameters are going to be chosen to satisfy just a higher order equation. So we just want the second derivative of the frequency spectra to now be zero at this pi over 2 point. So by doing this, it's flatter in this region. You also should make the bumps disappear as well. Okay, so we're able to solve these guys exactly. We have some much more complicated solutions for the tangent angles of these guys. And in this case, the solution of these wavelets we generate don't actually correspond to any known family of wavelets. So these Dobuchet, Hoyflitz, singlets are kind of some known families. These don't work. These don't work, it turns out, in these higher order constructions. You can't properly align them to get coherent superpositions that you need. Okay, so these are this is sort of some custom wavelets we're using from here on. Okay, we've added a bunch more layers, so again, you might complain this doesn't look like a mirror anymore, that you now have a bunch of unitary guys in each layer. But a mirror with more than one layer of disentanglers in each mirror layer can always be mapped to a normal mirror of larger bond dimension. So we just group some of our isometries and unitaries together into a thicker index tensor like this, and then we can map, we can always map a mirror with an arbitrary number of layers to just a thicker bond dimension mirror, a binary mirror. So usually if we want to increase the accuracy of our ansatz, what we do is just increase the bond dimension. We don't increase the number of layers. So you can always map the one with extra layers to the thicker bond dimension, but you can't actually go back the other way in general. So this gives you far more variational parameters than you have by just doing this.
Isn't this fact that you have far more variational parameters make it also harder for numerical optimization to optimize over those parameters? So if you know something about the structure like the one on top, wouldn't it be better to use that and optimize over that structure?
In practice, having more variational parameters also allows you to get a better solution. Yeah, I mean, and so in the numerical black box, we've sort of tried doing both approaches. This one was found out to be more efficient, so this is computationally less efficient to implement it this way, but you could. Okay, so that was our mirror for free fermions at half filling. What I really want is to get the mirror for the quantum critical Ising model. So this is the simplest CFT.
Actually, just a quick question. Why is half filling so special for you?
It just makes life much easier because well, you can exploit the symmetry, the particle hole symmetry.
Okay.
Potentially you could do it away from half filling, and then the bottom layers may have sort of more ones than zeros. It would just be a much more complicated construction. So what I really want is the quantum critical Ising model. This is our simplest CFT. It's the one we test a lot of things in. So it'll be nice if we can actually get the ground state for this out. And the good news is we can, just from the solution we previously constructed. So first of all, if we take these free spinless fermions, we can rewrite things in terms of 2N Majorana fermions. So each spinless fermion becomes 2 Majorana fermions. In principle, this allows us to kind of flip up this dispersion relation. We can change what we call a particle in a hole, in some sense. And once you have this guy, when it goes up, this looks like two copies of free Majorana fermions. And that free Majorana fermions would just have one of these peaks. So there's some well-known transformation that I can do to this guy from free fermions, free spinless fermions, to decouple it into two copies of free Majorana fermions. So I do this decoupling, and then I do the Jordan-Wigner, and I can get back to the Hamiltonian for the quantum Ising model, which looks like just one of these peaks.
Sorry, can we just talk through the counting again? So on each site, so say you work at some cutoff and there's n sites. What's the Hilbert space at each site in terms of dimension?
It's a free spinless spin.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's like a spin. It's like a spin at each site.
Mm-hmm.
So then when you say free fermions, is it with the usually I think of each one of those, so I see, so then each one of those spins corresponds to 2 Majoranas.
Each spin is mapped to 2, yeah.
But then those should get doubled again, right, from fermion doubling. or maybe this is different at half filling, I don't know, but usually that's what happens if you have like, if you're trying to put a mirror on a fermion in the lattice. Because there's you get low energy states from zero momentum, but then also from momentum, in the next band or whatever. Maybe I'm just confused.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that. I mean, this.
That one is just from crossing the barrier level twice.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So maybe it's just the other side of that.
The other side of.
I mean, to make a representation of the Majorana algebra with the anti-commutator of psi with psi is a delta function. Each two Majorana fermions makes a two-dimensional potential. So I interpreted that as you're going from n to 2n in the first red arrow.
That part is correct. Yeah.
Yeah, but then. Then when you write down the Hamiltonian psi, deep psi.
Oh, but I mean, we're not.
Maybe you're not writing down.
I mean, we're just transforming the Hamiltonian we have into this different representation. We're not trying to write it.
Oh, write it as a local Hamiltonian?
It is a local Hamiltonian. I mean, this is just some simple transformation you can do just by substitution.
Yeah.
It all works.
Maybe. Do you have both left and right numbers?
Yeah, I mean they're.
Okay.
You have two Fermi points.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I mean this is just some derivation you can do. It's kind of technical and tricky. At the end of it, you get out. You go three fermions, two copies of some, free fermions, some Majorana representation, two copies of free Majorana fermions to the quantum critical IC model. So this was the transformation of the Hamiltonian, and you can do the transformation, the corresponding transformation on the state to get out a tensor network representation of the quantum critical IC model where each of these is now acting on a spin half particle, spin half spin. Okay, so you can ask me about the details of that later on if you want. When we do this mapping, we actually get out something remarkably simple for these unitary gates. So my mirror is comprised of these U's and these W's, each act on two spins. I can write the unitaries, these unitaries in a basis of Pauli operators. I get out some surprisingly simple coefficients in front of them. Okay, so this solution has just come from the D2 Dobuchet wavelets. I can get out, if I go to my higher order wavelets, I get out a bunch of gates that look similar but with different coefficients, which I can group into larger tensors if I want to. Okay, so let's go into analyzing how well these solutions actually work. So the simplest thing you can look at is the ground energy per site of the icing model. So you have an exactly known value, minus 1.273. The simplest solution gets within a 2% of this exact energy. As you go to these higher order solutions, you get back much better energy. Okay, so again, these are not fantastic in terms of numerical precision if you were doing a calculation, but they're pretty good considering how simple this is, that we only had two parameters we were tuning to get to this. And I thought also it would be a useful exercise to go through how we actually can extract the conformal data from the mirror in this instance. So in order to look at, first of all, the scaling operators, what we should do is try and understand how local operators coarse grain through the mirror. Okay, so mirror, I have this bounded causal width. If I think about this as acting as a coarse graining transformation on my operator, it's essentially sort of moving into the bog through this causal cone. I can show that in a bit more detail. So at my operator, I'm transforming by conjugation by one layer of the mirror. Okay, so what happens is u daggers cancel out all of them away from the operator. There's w's and w daggers cancel out. The only ones that only a small number remain, and this is how I get a local operator, three-site operator, maps to some new three-site operator at the coarser level. And so we call this guy that acts on my three-site operator to generate a new three-site operator, so everything in the purple, we call this the scaling super-operator of the mirror. So the mirror, there is actually two of them depending on where the operator sits. Usually we take the average of the two. Okay. So the operators that are invariant or transform invariantly under the scaling superoperator are the scaling operators of my theory. Their eigenvalues or the exponent of their eigenvalues is the scaling dimensions delta ray. So this is something we can do for our wavelet solutions. So here is so showing the identity, the sigma, the spin, and the epsilon. So these are primary fields of the Ising model, and I've put a few of their descendants in as well. And this is the spectrum we get from diagonalizing this scaling superoperator from this solution here. So this very simple solution is actually doing a pretty good job of encoding the smallest weight scaling dimensions of the CFT. Okay, so some of the values come out exactly, the integer values. Other ones are reproduced to some okay precision. As you increase the order of the wavelets, you tend to the exact values everywhere for these guys. Okay, what about non-local scaling operators? So these are, so we have a whole other family of scaling operators that have an operator, and in this case they have a string of Z's behind them. So these are sort of the fermionic operators. If I was still in fermionic degrees of freedom for the spinless fermions, then these would be the local operators and the other ones would be the non-local ones. But these are the non-local ones in spins. Okay, so how does something like this coarse grain, well, we can actually do it quite simply because these Z's commute with our tensors and they commute up, so they just get out of the way and things cancel as usual. So just coarse grains as usual, and what we get out is a new three-site coarse-grained operator that has a tail of Z's as well. Okay, so this guy here we call the scaling superoperator for non-local operators. So it's the same as before, you just have a little bit of the string in there. And again, you can diagonalize this. You can maybe even do it analytically for this simple solution we have to get out a spectrum of non-local scaling operators and scaling dimensions. This is what we get for the Ising model. So again, you have three primary fields, this mu called the disorder, your phi and your phi bar, your fermions. And again, we get out some of these guys come out with exactly the right scaling dimension. Other ones come out with approximately the right scaling dimension. Beyond this point, they kind of go wonky. You get ones that appear that shouldn't appear in the CFT. But as you sort of increase the order of the wavelets, you can actually get more and more of the scaling dimensions accurately. Okay, OPE coefficients from the mirror, operator product expansion. This is something we also know how to compute. So usually you just put two scaling operators side by side in the lattice. You look at how they coarse grain. In this case, they coarse grain into a four-site operator. It's not really important, but you can resolve this operator in a basis of four-site scaling operators. And so these coefficients that do that are your are the OPE coefficients of your CFT. I don't have data from the wavelet construction, but we've done this previously with variational mirror and they come out very well. Okay, so you recover, so all of the OPE coefficients of the primary fields come out very accurately, and again you can improve this systematically. What about central charge from the mirror? So that's the final sort of bit of conformal data. There are actually many ways to do this, like you could just look at scaling block entanglement entropy and compute it and figure out what the C is. There are much more elegant ways of doing this based on looking at the half system density matrix and looking at the contribution to entanglement per scale you can extract. So again, from our wavelet solutions, we get something which is fairly reasonable compared to the exact value of a half. So again, this is showing that these solutions we constructed actually are reproducing the proper amount of entanglement at all n scales.
Can you really, I mean, usually fitting a log is kind of a pain in the butt, I guess. Here, maybe you really have enough sites, it's fine.
Yeah, fitting the log is not elegant, but you can do it without fitting up. You can write down what the tensor network for the half system density matrix looks like, and then by looking at the appropriate transfer operator, this guy just appears as an eigenvalue of that. So you don't have to fit anything. Finishing a bit early, it's okay. So what I've described today is for free particle systems, free spinless fermions, quantum icing model, which relates to free Majorana fermions, how you can actually go about constructing a mirror for this. Okay, so based on wavelets. So hopefully you've gained, this is useful in gaining some intuition in how mirror actually works in practice. I think these analytic solutions will be very useful in trying to better understand, for instance, how a mirror encodes a CFT, how we can improve things, and basically, and how entanglement is stored in the mirror, how disentanglers work. I mean, it's just nice to have at least one example you can sort of do analytically and not have to resort to numerics. We've understood sort of how the bulk boundary mapping works exactly in this case. And as I said, it's useful. Like as John was saying, maybe you can analytically derive some bounds on the accuracy based on this. Okay, and this is part of some sort of larger program I've been working on with Steve, where we're exploring connections between wavelets and mirror. So I actually gave him, I talked about this in John, when I was still at John's group. So here we've learned how wavelets can be used to construct these analytic approximations to the ground state. What we're also exploring is the other way around, is that some of the stuff we've learned in mirror, how to construct these circuits and so forth, could actually be very useful in the context of these wavelets, for instance, in designing better wavelet transformations. Thanks for your attention.
I missed a basic point. So if you didn't have the exact answers to compare to, how would you know that you're approaching the correct answer besides the fact that it's converging to some number as chi increased?
In the general setting, like if I'm doing a variation?
Just in this, if you somehow just didn't have the exact parameters to compare to, what's something you can look at to give you faith that this is going to be the correct answer as opposed to just...
In general, we don't have a lot. So all of these tensor network approaches, I mean, MERA, MPS, PEPS, they're variational ansatz. So you put it there, you optimize as much as you can, you hope it's a good solution, but you don't have any way of checking that really, or really robust way. There are other ways of getting to a tensor network. So say I start with a path integral and I do manipulations, I can transform this into something else, a mirror. And this way of constructing things, you can actually have bounds on how accurate it is. Like if I start with something exact and transform it into something else, then I can figure out the errors at each step. So that's sort of a different approach to doing tensor networks.
You could have considered a free fermion Hamiltonian pairing terms, A H on to A H on, where you could still solve it with Bogoluba transformation. Mm-hmm. But do you know how it works in that case? What the corresponding wavelet transform looks like?
Well, at least for one case of the free spinless with pairing terms, it can just be mapped to, well, free spinless with pairing terms coming back to free Majorana with just a DAG A terms.
Well, that's true.
So
but I guess as far as an analytic description, you know, you knew what to do with half filling or half particle bus. Okay, so you say there is no novelty associated with pairing terms.
If you gave me the one with pairing terms, I'd transform it into the one without and solve that.
Do you have some understanding of why certain scaling dimensions that you calculate are very exact and why the other ones are not? What divides the two?
Not a good understanding. Yeah, it's something I would like to think about more. So somehow some of the scaling operators can be represented compactly in space, I would think, and some of them cannot be like two-sided or one-sided operator. So it's an interesting thing to think about.
Is there possibly some tweak that you could do to your construction that would actually get them all to be exact?
Yeah, it's not out of the question that you could exactly reproduce the low-lying spectrum and still, like, you can't get everything, all of the descendants, because you only have finite dimension in your index, but it's not out of the question that maybe there is some tweak you can get exactly the low ones correctly.
So, the one that you say that you describe the most in the process is half-filling. And there you were doing your gauge for number preserving in terms of the fermion, and then you were protecting up the zero state and the one state. So that essentially you were preserving this half filling at every level. Did you think of doing this with any exact fraction filling?
That would be pretty reasonable. Like if I had one layer at the bottom that was all projecting onto zeros, and then I could maybe get back to a half filling starting from three quarter filling or something.
Right, or like if you have one third filling, have three output legs, get some increase. And the second question to that is, are there exotic phases that are interesting that you could study in this way?
No, I really don't think so. I mean, this is. All of these models can be solved by going to Fourier space, unless there was sort of real space. Well, maybe there are real space things you want to better understand that. Again, there are ways of getting this just analytically, but.
You got quite a lot of mileage from having a conserved particle number in the mirror structure. Gains quite a lot. Is there something you can do to the structure of the mirror if you just know more generically that you've got a conserved current in the theory you want to describe that you can actually restrict it and get some...
This part wasn't specific to the wavelet construction. So usually if we have a global symmetry of our Hamiltonian, there is some restriction we can do on the tensors locally based upon preserving the symmetry. So for the icing model, I have Z2 symmetry. I can already set half of the parameters of my tensors to zero by choosing them appropriately.
It'd be nice if you can sort of map that to a bulk gauge field.
Can't help but ask, there's also something called shapelets that people use in higher dimensions, or at least in one higher dimension. Does this have any relevance to trying to do this?
I don't know. I mean, there are a whole zoo of wavelets for higher dimensions that some have like a sort of angled and more than come with an angle as well. And I don't know.
Thank you, Glenn.